Good evening and welcome to the last class of Buddha Nature series. In this class series, as you know, we did not finish this fascicle and probably will not tonight. But luckily, we have 7-day sesshin coming with 7 Dharma talks. And I plan to continue going through this wonderful essay while we still have it in front of us, because who knows when such an opportunity might come again. Because it's the longest Shobo Genzo fascicle. For example, when Shohaku Okamura Roshi taught this in the Genzo-e Sesshin, he had to split it into 2 sesshins or more. So I don't feel bad that we didn't finish. So last time we talked about the section on impermanence, is Buddha nature. Short but important section, and just to follow up on that a little bit before we move on. As you may recall, that it's taught in all these Indian teachings that Buddha nature is without change. Like a copy? One of the qualities of Buddha nature is permanence. And remember at the very beginning of this essay, Dogen says, quotes the Parinirvana Sutra, saying, "All sentient beings, without exception, have Buddha nature. The Tathagata abides forever without change." So there's this, it was understood to be an unchanging, not a thing, not a phenomena, but a the changeless nature of mind. So this is an unusual teaching that Dogen brings up, quoting the 6th ancestor of Zen, saying impermanence is Buddha nature. But again, this is a little different than saying Buddha nature is impermanent. It's saying impermanence itself is Buddha nature. And we have this, I thought of after that last class, case number 75 in the Book of Serenity is called Ryu Yen's Fundamental Constant Principle, or Fundamental Permanent Principle. And we could say it's maybe about this. So Ryu Yen asks the other ancestor, Yen To, what is the fundamental constant principle? And Yen To says, moving. What's the fundamental, constant, unmoving, unchanging principle? Moving. And then Ryu Yen says, when moving, then what? And Yen To says, you don't see the fundamental, constant principle. And the case goes on a little bit more, but I thought this demonstrates this principle. What's the one fundamental unchanging principle? Movement. Or sometimes I've heard it said, the only thing that never changes is change itself. Or the only thing that's permanent is impermanence. Impermanence is continually impermanent, isn't it? Impermanence never ceases. Therefore, it's kind of like an underlying fundamental constant principle. Though we could hear this in teaching of the 6th ancestor in this way, that impermanence itself is this unchanging Buddha nature. Impermanence also implies the interdependent arising and ceasing of the whole world of appearances. In that way, the dependent arising and dependent ceasing of everything, that ungraspable reality we appear to live in, is Buddha nature. So this is, there's a book called Impermanence is Buddha Nature in English by Joan Stombach, I think a Western philosopher who's into Dogen also. So one thing she says about this is the relation, in quotes, between impermanence and Buddha nature is one formulation for a whole set of relations that can be alternatively expressed as samsara-nirvana, or practice-realization. Or she even says, in Western terms, this is like the relation of the finite to the infinite, or of the world to God. And I don't know how they deal with this in Western terms, but this kind of dichotomy, this problem of these two sides in Buddha Dharma has been something to explore from the earliest days when the Buddha taught samsara is this cycle of impermanence arising and ceasing, that we're trapped in this cycle of suffering and birth and death. And nirvana is like the cure for samsara in the early teachings, right? Nirvana is the unchanging, unborn, undying reality that is the freedom from samsara, the actual, the end of samsara. So you probably heard this before, but this is like this kind of like, in the early teachings, they're like the opposite ends of the spectrum, right? We have samsara that we're stuck in, and nirvana is like the end of samsara. And then we have teachers like Nagarjuna, who was maybe the first to explicitly teach that samsara itself is precisely nirvana, and there's not the slightest difference between the two. This is chapter 25 of Nagarjuna's fundamental verses on the middle way. And he goes into the kind of the proof for how that's so, because such statements like this are can't just be kind of randomly thrown out. In fact, so Joan, in his book here, quotes Nagarjuna's verses there on samsara is essentially not different from nirvana and so on. And but then she says the whole problem and the whole difficulty is to understand what these statements are really saying. It cannot be the case that early Buddhism conceived of nirvana as release from samsara, and then Nagarjuna came along and proclaimed that samsara is nirvana in the sense that there is no liberation from samsara, or that no liberation is possible or necessary. No Buddhist has ever said that. I thought that's a good point she makes it, because we might think, cool, we're off the hook now. Samsara is actually nirvana, so that means no problem, we're done with our practice. He said, it's not that easy, right? Even though it's true here. We just have to understand what it means. Nor can the identity of samsara and nirvana mean that samsara, just as the deluded person perceives it, is in and of itself nirvana. Although there we might start to argue with exactly what Nagarjuna means. And I've mentioned this before to at least some of you. Maybe Nagarjuna wouldn't say it exactly like this, but this is something my teacher, Tenzin Roshi, once said that I thought was a wonderful mind-turning statement about these terms, samsara and nirvana, and the relationship between them. He said that, so what are the definitions of these terms? What is samsara? the cycle of birth and death and suffering that we're stuck in. Samsara is simply meddling with nirvana. In other words, like nirvana is the actual way things are. And when we start meddling with that, and meddling can take many forms, right? Meddling is basically the freedom from all conceptual fabrications and that we actually live in. Meddling is kind of like conceptually fabricating a world where there actually isn't one, you could say, is maybe the bottom line meddling. So samsara is defined as simply meddling with nirvana. So now what we want to know, well, what's nirvana? What's the definition of nirvana? It's simply not meddling with samsara. I thought that was just a brilliant way to talk about these two terms. And there's a practice behind it too, right? It's the practice. Nirvana is realized when samsara, just as it is, you know, the cycle of arising and ceasing, without without meddling with it, is itself nirvana. In other words, we could say the dependent co-arising of everything, the interdependent arising of this apparent world and the ceasing moment to moment, this impermanent world, not adding the slightest wish for it to slow down. We're getting older too fast, or speed up, we've been young for too long, or anything else like that, right? Those would be examples of meddling with the arising and ceasing that's happening each moment. But just the, you know, completely unmeddled, pure, fresh, present, arising, without the slightest addition or subtraction, is freedom, is it not? The bondage comes in when we think, but. And then try to do something here. So one last thing she says, this is all, you know, a little bit of commentary on impermanence itself, Buddha nature. Joan Stombach also says, in relation to this, if Buddha nature is already here, if our fundamental endowment is Buddha nature, if everything is Buddha nature, then what about practice? And, you know, Dogen's classic question, if practice and realization of Buddhahood are not two, then this is the resolution of this issue, that Buddha nature is right there at the moment of practice. So the way she puts this is a relatively simple and by no means profound or exhaustive answer to Dogen's existential koan of why must we practice if we already inherently possess Buddha nature, might run as follows. Most people would agree that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was a prodigious musical genius who possessed a great musical gift. But even though he possessed such genius, whatever that may mean, had he spent his youth in other pursuits and perhaps become a merchant or a businessman, the genius would have been of no use whatsoever. The gift would have lain dormant, undeveloped. Here Sartre would quip, if he didn't develop that so-called gift, then there is no sense in speaking of a gift. He did not do it. Kind of interesting, huh? Like a natural gift that everyone's endowed with, but if you don't learn music, it's useless.
If you didn't practice the piano.
Practice the piano. So she goes on to say, the main difficulty with this example, though, is that it stresses the notion of development And Dogen would never say that the Buddha nature is something to be developed. So it's a little bit, Dogen's a little bit more subtle and radical, because it's not something that you have to gradually uncover this Buddha talent or genius that you have in you. It's not to be developed. It's fully here, and it's just moment to moment. It's maybe more like at the moment Mozart plays his first piano notes as a 5-year-old or something, ding, 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 it's already like musical genius. Which we maybe wouldn't say that, but in Dogen's example, we would say that that clinking on the keys is already like manifesting his complete genius, and then he just keeps doing it. Did you have it?
Well, I was just going to say, the practice, it has to be realized. You can have it, but if you don't know that you have it, then it's kind of like Mozart.
Yeah.
If you didn't play.
Yeah. And Dogen might even go even further to say, even if you know you have it, you still have to manifest it.
Yeah.
You have to actualize.
Yeah, realize.
And that's why practice and realization, like, it's a moment-to-moment thing. And what practice means is, we can discuss more today as we get into this next story. But offhand, we could say practice is a moment-to-moment letting go of our self-clinging. And then here it is, the Buddha nature that we knew we had, that's not doing us any good. Suddenly it's like, oh yes, now it's like it's flowing freely because we're not holding on. So she just finishes here.
Okay.
Yes.
I want to say about Mozart.
Yeah.
Mozart couldn't not play the piano, and he couldn't not write music. He couldn't not do it. As soon as it was presented to him as an opportunity, he couldn't just... had to do it, and he was, So it's actually a really good example if you're thinking in terms of that, because he just couldn't not.
Yeah, a lot of
the problem would have been if he had never been presented with the piano, so he probably would have found something else because it was so inherently a part of him.
Mm-hmm. He just wanted to, we could say, practice something really wholeheartedly, and piano is the thing that came to him. We might say that would be interesting.
But the music was in his head, was always there, and he always was composing. Probably, I wonder, even as a little, younger than when he started, the music was always there.
I think most musical geniuses and artists tend to be totally obsessed about their genius, their talent, I think of many stories and movies about this. It's the Beautiful Mind, about the mathematician, right? It's like, couldn't stop being totally obsessed with math. Drove him crazy in the end, right?
So, is that Buddha nature? That's his skill. He lets go.
Is the obsession the Buddha nature, you mean?
Yeah.
I guess we could say that the Buddha nature, the way that Dogen's been talking about Buddha nature, is it's like, in a way, it's everything that's arising and ceasing all the time, but we're not kind of like in touch with it so much, even though all beings are Buddha nature, always. It's like, when it's to manifest the Buddha nature, is when it becomes like this wholehearted doing. So you could say, obsession generally, we don't call such a positive thing, right? It's kind of like too much sometimes, right? It's like over the top. But you could say total wholeheartedness to the point of forgetting everything else. That is like manifesting the Buddha nature. And maybe we could call it obsession. In the positive sense of obsession. Like Dogen was kind of fanatical practitioner, it seemed like, constantly thinking and writing this stuff and constantly encouraging, total, wholehearted sitting. It's just that this, the funny thing in the Zen practice is all this energy and devotion and wholehearted expression goes into this non-doing, mm-hmm. just sitting still, but total energetically and bringing our whole life to it. Of course, other things too, but Dogen really emphasizes Zazen is like the center that everything revolves around. Total wholehearted. I mean, Shikan Taza means just wholeheartedly, completely, devotedly sitting. Just that. So, however, if we downplay the idea of development in this Mozart example and instead emphasize practice, the example may still retain some validity. No practice, no pianist. No composing, no Mozart. No practice, no Buddha nature. That's Jung Stambach. So now we're on to the next story, long story here. Long commentary anyway, from Dogen, about Nagarjuna. This is the bottom of page 4 on this Xerox, where it begins, the sage Ryuju Somja, the 14th ancestor, is called Nagarjuna in Sanskrit. In Chinese, he's called Lungshu, Lungsheng, and also Lungmeng. So, be nice if they had translated these. But what they actually mean, Lungshu or Ryuju in Japanese, is the most common way in Chinese that they translate basically Nagarjuna's name. Like when we chant in the mornings, we actually say Nagyahara Juna Daiyosho. We transliterate. Sometimes they'll translate directly into Chinese, and what Kumara Jiva, the great translator, used that stuck is Ryuju, which means dragon tree. Because Nagas are like, they translate it in Chinese as dragon. Nagas are these serpent. They're part of Indian cosmology. They're like underwater serpents, like sea monsters. And you probably heard the story of Nagarjuna. Arjuna is the name of the great hero of the, what's it called? The great Hindu epic. Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavad Gita's hero is named Arjuna, which means like accomplished one, I think. So it's just a beautiful name for a strong warrior. And Nagarjuna is, you could say, is the one who's accomplished by the Nagas, because he was a practitioner, and these dragon creatures have been storing the Prajnaparamita Sutras under the ocean for many centuries, waiting for the time to bring them out. And they're like, this guy Nagarjuna, he had some other name at that point, is the one who's going to like, is ready to understand these and expound them fully for the world. So the Nagas said, come here, come close to the edge of the lake here. And they started, you know, passing up all the Prajnaparamita Sutras from the ocean to Nagarjuna. There's paintings of this. You can see with the Nagas, they look like snakes, all kind of like surrounding, protecting Nagarjuna's head, and then other Nagas from the water passing the sutras up to him. So he got his name because his accomplishment was aided by the Nagas. So but I guess Arjuna also in Sanskrit means some kind of tree, some kind of fruit tree. So dragon tree, but Lungshen means dragon victory. That's maybe more like, I would understand, Naga Arjuna. And Lungmen is dragon ferocity. And Ryuju Sonja. Sonja just means like noble person, an Arya, a realized one. He was a native of Western India. He went to Southern India, where many believed that good fortune was obtained through worldly acts, or it says karma, and he preached the wondrous dharma. And in fact, good fortune does come from good karma. We had a discussion about that the other week. Good happiness comes from being kind and helpful, what we call good karma. So, but I think this implies people believe that's all there was to Buddha Dharma, was just doing good works, good karma. And they needed some more dharma along with that, even though it is true. Those who heard it said to one another, good fortune is the greatest thing you can receive in this world. The teacher speaks emptily of a Buddha nature. Who has ever seen it? So this is the problem. They think the greatest thing in the world is good karma. And maybe we could say that is true, that in the greatest thing in the world. But that's the, you know, the greatest mundane activity of the world is good karma. But then there's transcending our usual understanding of the world. So they're kind of criticizing this empty Buddha nature idea, like, what good is that? And who's ever seen such a thing? Because we're into, like, what we can see in the world. Nagarjuna said, if you want to see the Buddha nature, first you must eliminate self-egoism, or maybe more literally, like, self-conceit or self-pride. And there's different lists in the early teachings of different types of conceit or pride, and one of them is the conceit that one has an independent self, like kind of like I'm me. At least I got. I'm maybe not such a good person or anything, but at least I'm me, and I really am me. That's kind of like a conceit or a pride. Don't tell me otherwise. First, you must eliminate this self-pride, pride in the independent, individual, permanent, unchanging self, which is the culprit of the condition for all kinds of discontent in the Buddha's teaching. So I think that's a great basic teaching from Nagarjuna. If you wish to see Buddha nature, first just eliminate or let go of, release self-conceit. But they didn't just decide to do that. They wanted to ask some more details. Like, well, so how big is this Buddha nature of yours? How big is your Buddha nature? Nagarjuna said, Buddha nature is neither large nor small, broad nor narrow. It's not happiness or good fortune. We might say in parentheses, or unhappiness, a bad fortune. It's not obtained as a reward for something. It's undying and unborn, like nirvana. It's beyond good karma and its rewards. When the people understood the superlative nature of the truth embodied in Nagarjuna's teaching, all of them abandoned their original beliefs and became his followers. Or literally it says, they converted to beginner's mind and became his followers. At another time, as Nagarjuna was sitting, he manifested a body of absolute freedom. It was just like the round full moon. Not a person in the assembly saw the master's form. They heard only the sound of the Dharma. This body of absolute freedom is Jizai Shin. So we say the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, practicing Prajnaparamita. And we usually translate her name into Chinese as Kanon or Kanzeon. But as you know, chanting the Chinese Heart Sutra, we say, Kanji Zai Bosatsu. Instead of Kanzeon, strange, unusual name, but it's the same Jizai, which literally means like self-abiding. And Kan, it's the same Kan of Kanzeon, which means like regarding or contemplating. Kanzeon is regarding the sounds of the world, or contemplating the sounds of the world, because she's the great compassion bodhisattva. But when she's practicing deeply Prajna Paramita, her name changes. You know, and maybe this is another way of translating Avalokiteshvara. But it's interesting when we have this teaching that's more emphasizing emptiness, wisdom teachings, as opposed to the compassion teachings. She's called Kanji Zai Bosatsu, which means contemplating or regarding the self-abiding nature of things, or maybe more. That's kind of literal, those two characters, but as a compound, they mean like freedom or kind of unhindered freedom, self-abiding, like the freedom that's unconstrained by others, you could even say. So Nagarjuna manifested this Jizai body, this self-abiding body or body of absolute freedom. You could say Avalokiteshvara, when practicing deeply Prajna Paramita, was contemplating absolute freedom. And thus she clearly saw that all five skandhas are empty. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Could you translate once more time the
Kan
and the
G? Kan, Jizai. So Kan means like to regard or contemplate. It's also the character that's used to translate the Sanskrit word vipassana. Mm-hmm. So you could say insight would be another insight into self-abiding. Insight, contemplate, or regard. And Jizai, Ji means self, like bigger, big self. And Zai means, you know, to abide or reside. So maybe it could be roughly kind of like word by word translated as like contemplate it. This is the way Tenshin Roshi sometimes would talk about it, is contemplating the way the self abides. The true self abides, contemplating the abiding of the true self. But in Chinese, when you put the Jizai together as a compound, they don't usually literally mean self abiding. They mean like unhindered freedom as a compound. So this is the Jizai Shin, manifested a body of absolute freedom. Just like the round full moon, not a person in the assembly saw the master's form. And so this word form is going to appear throughout here. This is not the form in the Heart Sutra. Form is emptiness. It's a character in Chinese that is used to translate lakshana, which means like characteristics, and also used to translate the Sanskrit nimitta, which means like signs. So it's pretty dynamic, and those are pretty similar, the characteristics of things and the signs of things. But they're used in somewhat different ways in Sanskrit, and for some reason the Chinese decided to use this character to refer to both of those terms. So when you're getting into some of the subtle Dharma teachings, like the Sandinya Mochana Sutra, this character is used a lot, and when studying that it got very confusing for us, because you don't know, we don't have the original Sanskrit sutra. But nimitta, or sign, is like the identifying feature of something by which we know it. Like the signs of this piece of paper are those qualities by which we are able to know that it's a piece of paper. And the lakshana, or the characteristics of the paper, or attributes of the paper, are very similar, but it's not so much the way by which we know it. It's more like the quality, like that it's flat and white and has writing on it, would be like the marks of the paper. Anyway, we might not have to get into these technicalities so much here, but that's the word that's being used here. But, where it's not a person in the assembly saw the master's characteristics or signs at the time that he manifested the full moon. People often translate it as form, but I don't think I would choose that word.
Well, there's a whole piece in the Diamond Sutra about characteristics.
Yeah, that's Lakshana.
And signs.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, both of those words, I think, are actually used in the Diamond Sutra and Prajnaparamita in general. Whereas form, like rupa in Sanskrit, generally means like, solidity. It's kind of a more specific, and the form, skanda, is rupa, like, that which can be touched. But all three of those were terms could be sometimes translated as form in English. No one saw the master's characteristics or signs. They only heard the sound of the Dharma. Among the gathering was Kanadeva. We say Kanadaiva Daiyosho. He's Nagarjuna's heir. And actually, so he's in our Zen lineage, but really important in India too, known as Aryadeva, often in India, and actually was a student of Nagarjuna, and continued to write middle way treatises commenting on Nagarjuna and his own, still really important in the middle way tradition, Aryadeva's, Kanadeva's works. And Kana means apparently one-eyed, and can't resist telling the story of how he got his name. He's also called Aryadeva, but his kind of maybe his nickname is Kanadeva, and kind of nice that we in Zen know him as Kanadeva, the one-eyed Deva. Deva means is like a god, like celestial being, but that's kind of his Dharma name, right? He's not an actual Deva. But he was walking along the road one day, and before he went walking, his teacher Nagarjuna said, "When you're walking along the road today, you're gonna come across someone who will ask you for a gift, and since you're a great bodhisattva, you should give that gift, right?" And it might be really hard for you to give completely, but you're practicing Dana Paramita, so please, if you give completely without any hesitation and without regret, you will gain back everything that you've given. So you won't lose anything, as long as you have no regret about giving. Because that kind of like defeats the whole giving, if you regret it. It kind of undermines the letting go completely that we call giving. So he's like, "No problem." And he comes along, walking along the road, and there's a poor, blind beggar there. "Stop, stop, I hear you, somebody on the road there. I'm so suffering. I haven't been able to see, and I can't find any food. Food's good, but then I just like, I have some and then no one comes along and I can't find it again. So like, what I really want is a human eye to see. Will you please, whoever you are, give me one of your eyes?" So Aryadeva at that time said, "Okay, here goes. My teacher said it would be okay." And I'm like not holding back on the bodhisattva path. And I have two of them, so he pulled out his eye somehow, said, "Here you go." And this is the way I heard this story. The beggar was like, said, "Oh, thank you so much." And he tried to like squeeze it into his eye socket and like, "This doesn't work. Wait a second. This good for nothing eye," and he smashed it on the road. And Aryadeva, who was just walking away at this point, looked back and had just like the slightest thought of regret. Was that a waste of a good eye? And if he didn't have that regret, who knows if his eye would have miraculously reappeared. But because he did, he was known from then on as the one-eyed Deva. But I think it's just a great story about giving wholeheartedly without regret. And hopefully we will not get such outrageous requests in this lifetime. We have to be very far along the Bodhisattva path before such requests start arising. Anyway, among the gathering was Kanadeva. So, can you discern his lakshanas, his nimitta, his form, his characteristics, his signs? He asked the others. Kanadeva asked the group. "Our eyes see nothing," they answered. "Our ears hear nothing. Our minds discern nothing. Our bodies experience nothing." So we don't know what exactly happened here, but Nagarjuna manifested this full moon shape, which Dogen's going to talk about his understanding of that. And everybody had this kind of like entered this emptiness samadhi or something, where like we don't see or hear or feel anything right now. Kanadeva said, "That itself is the form of the sage Nagarjuna, the noble one, manifesting Buddha nature. He's doing it to teach us." So manifesting Buddha nature here is, in Chinese, that word gen. Keep bringing up the gen of genjo koan, manifesting, actualizing, expressing. So it's genbusho. Actually, it's genbusho so. And so is that character that means lock, characteristic or mark. So it's manifesting the Buddha nature mark, or manifesting the sign of Buddha nature. Genbusho so. He's doing it to teach us. How do I know this? Because the form of formless samadhi is like the full moon. The meaning of Buddha nature is absolutely empty, clear, and distinct. So here, the form of formless samadhi, this is a clue that maybe nimitta or sign is a better translation here, because there is, you may have heard, these three types of samadhi in the early and Mahayana teachings. This is a classic list of three types of absorption, meditative absorption. The empty samadhi, the shunya samadhi is empty samadhi. The is it the selfless samadhi? It's probably in one of these footnotes. Maybe it's not. The empty samadhi. Oh, the wishless samadhi. The absorption in not wishing for anything other than what's happening, and the signless samadhi, which in Sanskrit is the animitta samadhi. So, because he's actually using that word here, maybe sign is, if you put all the way through this story, is the best translation. The signless samadhi, animitta samadhi, which would mean like absorption, meditative absorption, where there's no signs by which you can know objects, right? Like it'd be like you're so absorbed that you can't identify a piece of paper, right? Because the signs by which we know it are not outside the mind. So again, this Sandhya Mochana Sutra has a very subtle, elaborate teaching on the way to remove signs from objects, which we won't get into that, but it's an interesting way of talking about, instead of like stopping the mind grasping at signs, the sutra talks about removing signs of objects. It's like, let's remove the signs from the piece of paper now. This is like a meditative practice you can actually cultivate according to the instructions in the sutra. You can remove the signs of objects. Basically, it's about non-duality and nothing outside the mind. It's basically the way signs are removed. Anyway, that's the signless samadhi. That would be my understanding of that one. And you know, signless samadhi, empty samadhi, and wishless samadhi, maybe not that different. They're probably like, you know, like three different aspects of the same one-pointed, non-dual absorption. But they are listed that way. When Kanadeva finished speaking, the round shape disappeared and Nagarjuna was sitting on his seat as before. He recited a verse. It goes, body manifesting a round moon shape. And again, this, again, the manifesting. And round moon shape is, Enso. I heard it, you know, Enso is like a Zen circle, right? We call it Enso. And En means, can mean circle, but also means complete, or fulfilled, or perfect. It has all those meanings. It's interesting that in Chinese they use the word circle to mean perfect and complete. And so actually is the same so of this nimitta character, and an enso is a, so you could say it's a complete form or a complete characteristic. Form maybe works best in an enso. It's the same character though. You could say complete sign, but also round. So I think it's a little, it's a Zen thing, right? For Zen teachers to draw circles because they're a sign of completeness. I've actually seen enso translated that way as sign of completeness. But it's also going to be translated as circular form. It's kind of neat that way, huh? Enso. And here they just put moon in between. Moon is getsu, so it's en getsu so. So you could say the complete moon form. Or here it says round moon form. But, you know, that's what we're talking about here is moon. Completeness of the moon and full moon in Zen is, you know, represents Buddha's awakened mind, complete, edgeless, bright, clear moon. But interestingly, the moon was chosen as such an image as opposed to the sun. Sometimes the sun gets used too, but the moon is something like it's mysterious and it's cool and it's that kind of feminine aspect too, right? So the moon of awakening. It's not like looking directly at the sun, which blinds you if you look right at it, but you can stare at the moon for hours and reflected light, so you know. Yeah, there's all kinds of metaphorical implications about the moon. Of course, Genjo Koan has a lot of moon imagery too. Body manifesting a round or complete moon sign, an en-getsu so, expressing thereby the body of the Buddhas, expounding Dharma without any form, expounding without sight or sound. So that's the story of Nagarjuna, which is found in the transmission of lamp stories. You should know true expounding is not, this is Dogen now commenting. You should know true expounding is not directly manifested in sight or sound. True Dharma preaching has no form or characteristics. Nagarjuna preached the Buddha Dharma widely in countless sermons. Here I present only a brief account of one small portion of them, or one corner of them. And he brings up Nagarjuna's line, if you want to see Buddha nature, you must first eliminate self-conceit. And I think one interesting point here is that the word see is ken. So we have this word kensho in Rinzai Zen that we've talked about before, the Dogen is kind of critical of. Kensho means seeing nature. It's the show, busho. And I think it means Buddha nature. For short, just called seeing your true nature and seeing Buddha nature. And ken literally means seeing. So kensho means seeing your nature, and it's kind of like the maybe goal of Rinzai Zen practice. And for some reason, that I think that the problems that Dogen has with it are maybe even more exaggerated in American Zen, because it's it often doesn't even get translated as seeing nature. Seeing nature is a verb, an activity, but it becomes in English it becomes a noun, and you have to get kensho. It's like, how did that happen? Why did they do that?
And there's a before and an after.
Yeah. And it's all about attaining kensho, which would be, if you translate it, would be like attaining the seeing of nature. So we wouldn't really talk that way. We'd say like, we might say the point is actually seeing your nature. You really want to see your nature. But that's a little less kind of loaded and a little less graspy than you're going to get this thing called seeing nature. I don't know why. They just left it as this thing, and then it becomes like a noun, and it's not even translated so people, it's this mysterious thing called kensho that you gotta like grab a hold of. I think it's somewhat problematic. But the word, but kensho itself, I think could be a valuable teaching. We have talked about last week, I think, the path of seeing. There, even in the early teachings, there's, called Darshana Marg. Darshana means seeing. It's literally the path of seeing, and that's the moment of insight, even in the early teachings. So there is, it's valid to talk about a particular moment of seeing reality in a different way. Dogen downplays this because it's, for one thing, it implies that the point is this vision or seeing as opposed to practice. So like we were just talking about with Mozart, it's like if he just knew, like, I'm a musical genius, I really see that, I see my true musical genius, but then he didn't practice, that wouldn't be so useful. So Dogen emphasizes more the manifesting, the actualizing, the moment to moment, sit upright on the cushion and do it, and practice giving, and practice the precepts, and all these activities that we call practice, as opposed to just have some insight. And I think that's a beautiful emphasis in Dogen's teaching that we like very much. And also, I think that's one problem he sees with seeing nature as the point of it all, is it doesn't emphasize practice enough. And also, it's a little bit dualistic, or it could be interpreted a little bit dualistically to say, you are seeing something. Even if you're seeing Buddha nature, the very language, and you could say, actually, darshana marga or kensho is a non-dual experience. But in talking about it as seeing nature, it kind of implies that the nature is something other than you, right? If you're going to see something, you have to kind of place it out. You can't see your own eyeball, right? You have to place something outside yourself a little bit in order to see it. So that very language of talking about seeing something, even if it's seeing Buddha nature, Dogen picks up on that because he's into subtlety, right? So he's like, in other fascicles, he critiques this term. However, it's an important Zen term, and it actually goes back to Bodhidharma, his famous verse of talking about Zen, kind of defining Zen as the first Zen ancestor, saying that, you know, a separate transmission outside the written scriptures, pointing directly to the human heart or human mind, seeing nature, becoming Buddha. So maybe Bodhidharma was the one who coined this term Kensho, because that's what he says it first. And that's the kind of like defining the verse, defining Zen. It's all about seeing nature becoming Buddha. And Dogen might say, it's all about practicing nature already Buddha. Practicing nature, or manifesting Buddha, maybe we'd say, Dogen. So here's it when he's commenting here. Nagarjuna says, if you want to see Buddha nature, ken busho, you must first eliminate self-pride, self-conceit. Dogen says, you must without fail discern and affirm the essential significance of this. It does not mean the absence of seeing. So here's what he gives it a little, he gives Kensho a little credit here. Doesn't mean the absence of seeing. Seeing is in itself the elimination of self-conceit. So I think that's a beautiful way of looking at Kensho, actually. What is the seeing of your nature, this mysterious thing we're trying to get through some, you know, if we push hard enough? Well, it's actually just the dropping away of self, the self, the belief in self, the conceit, the pride in self.
Could you call it the practice of seeing, the practice of seeing nature?
Well, maybe that we could say that seeing nature, if we talk about it as a practice, is the practice of, I'm not sure what in Chinese elimination is, but you could say dropping away, or letting go of self-conceit. That's, I would say that's a practice, right? I mean, it might be like, I guess it's debatable whether we say that letting go is a practice, because you could say, I'm just wholeheartedly sitting. That's a practice. I'm putting all my attention on this present moment, nothing else, little bits and pieces of thoughts and concerns are coming up, and I'm just letting them go. And then in this practice of wholeheartedly sitting, letting go happens. So you could say the practice is wholeheartedly sitting, and then in the wholehearted sitting, dropping body and mind drop off, or the self-conceit is eliminated. And nature is seen, true nature, Buddha nature is seen at that moment. Not as even a byproduct, but the very dropping away of the self, the independent self, is seeing Buddha nature. But maybe we could say letting go is a practice. Is letting go the result of just wholehearted sitting, or is letting go a practice? Because sometimes it's like, I feel that I'm really holding on here. I'm clenching my view that person wronged me. Here in peaceful zazen, can you believe it? And like, I'm holding it, I'm not going to let it go because that person deserves my clenching.
And the more I think about it, the better it's going to be, right?
The better it's going to be. The more I hold this thought, the more like I get back at them. Meanwhile, they're just going about their happy life. It's really like, wait a second, I'm doing this to myself. Mm-hmm. And then we see, what about if I just take a deep breath and relax and let go? You say, that's maybe a practice, actually, right? of intentional, okay, I'm deciding now to just let go. I can do it, you know, to some extent. From another point of view, we maybe say, well, I don't do it. To say that I do the letting go is kind of self-conceit. So, you know, to say that I practice anything is self-conceit, right? But practice can happen, and practice and realization are not two. And practice, realization, and seeing nature, as Dogen's talking about here, are not three. So as you say, like this is not about the absence of seeing. We don't need to get rid of this ken of kensho. Seeing is, but let's like look at what it means. Seeing is in itself the elimination, the letting go of self-conceit. The self is not a single self. Self-egoism, self-conceit exists in a great variety. Eliminating is also of great diversity. But nevertheless, all are seeing Buddha nature. You must accustom yourself to your own ordinary seeing. Got really familiar, intimate with the way that we see things like the watch, because I can see, is there some self-conceit in my ordinary seeing? Let's get really familiar with this. Do I feel like I'm actually seeing a watch? This is a little bit conceited here. And I appreciate how he says, we're not just talking about this Atman independent self that we think, okay, we just work on this one here. I mean, it is this one, you could say, but it has many, many forms and varieties. It's like we're thinking, here we are, you know, obsessing about this person that wronged me, and like, okay, I release it, I let go. Wow, I feel so much lighter. There's like, I feel released from the self-conceit. I'm so cool. I actually, maybe this is kensho. I got it, I finally let go. I'm like, oh, here's another one. It's a little more self-conceit, but there's no end to this process. That's what I think what he means by the self's not a single self. You can drop away one self and you get another one to let go of, and then another one and another one. Self-conceit exists in great variety. And eliminating is also of great diversity, meaning like ways of letting go are numerous. Isn't it wonderful that we learn sometimes the hard way? We have to let go. Like sometimes it feels like this isn't letting go. This is like torture. This is like my life is being like ripped away from me. No, that's just another kind of letting go. Maybe we could say. Are another kind of eliminating. Do not associate an utterance such as "it's neither large nor small" with the commonplaces voiced by the unenlightened. The commonplaces voiced by the unenlightened or by those of the lesser vehicle. To conceive distortedly of the Buddha nature merely as a vast immensity is a case of illusory discrimination. So maybe he's saying, Buddha nature is neither large nor small, means then it must be really vast. It's like, no, it's not. It's just, and it's not like neither large nor small, like we're thinking about size or something. It's not like our commonplace views of these terms. And neither this nor that doesn't mean it is this. We've talked about it. Non-implicative negations before. You should think in just the same way that you hear. You should think in just the same way that you hear the truth that is totally tied up in the utterance. It is neither large nor small, being made right here and now. I hear this as, you should think in the way that you hear the way you hear these teachings when you just take them in. It's neither large nor small. Hearing it directly and taking it in and don't think too much about it. Don't, you know, overanalyze. Be one way to hear this. Just hear the Dharma, hear the true Dharma coming. Especially when we're reading Dogen, you know, sometimes it's like, what? Just hear, just take, drink in these strange words, and don't add a lot of extra thinking to it. So you should think in just the same way that you hear the truth that is totally tied up, or I would hear this is the truth that's kind of all interwoven with the utterance. It's neither large nor small. That's being made right here and now. This utterance, it's neither large nor small, is happening right now. And so hear it right now and think in the way that you hear it right now. That's because you're using hearing that's no different from thinking. Now let us attend to the verse Nagarjuna uttered. It says, body manifesting a round moon shape, expressing thereby the body of the Buddhas. Because the manifesting body is, as such, expressing thereby all Buddha bodies, it is the shape of the round moon. Hence all sizes, longs and shorts, and all forms, characteristics and signs, round and square, are to be studied in his manifesting body. To be unaware of the non-dualistic relation of body and manifesting is not only to be ignorant of the shape of the round moon, it's not the body of Buddhas either. So, Dogen's making the point that he's constantly harping on any sense of duality in any of these words. So he's saying, it's not like first you have a body over here and then you manifest it. It's like the body itself is a manifestation. So as you're going to see, he's saying, it's not like Nagarjuna had this kind of like some non-Buddha body and then he manifested this full moon body. You should not hear body and manifesting as two different things. Body is what we call manifesting. That's what a body is. You could take that up as a meditation. If you're practicing mindfulness of body in Zazen, for example, you could say, well, how is this body just actually a manifestation in the moment? It's just an expression of Buddha nature in the moment, as opposed to this like solid, chunky, aching thing on the cushion that wants to move. It's just a temporary manifestation of Buddha nature. Because the manifesting body is as such expressing thereby all Buddha bodies, it is the shape of the round moon. Hence all these sizes are to be studied in his manifesting body. To be unaware of this non-dual relation of body and manifesting is not only to be ignorant of the shape of the round moon, it's not the body of Buddhas either. The ignorant think he is temporarily manifesting a transformation body, nirmanakaya. That's his true nirmanakaya, like Buddha body, is this round moon shape. That is what is meant by a round moon shape. The ignorant think that the true Buddha body, this nirmanakaya, is the round moon shape. But that's an illusory notion held by those who have not received authentic transmission of the Buddha way. Where and when could you manifest another body not your own? When I become a round moon, everything will be so sweet. Nope. This is the one we're stuck with for a whole moment. And then it's gone. And then we get another one, another manifested body. But it's not some other body than this one. Dogen's very into. This very mind is Buddha. This very body is Buddha. You should know without any doubt that at the very time Nagarjuna was just sitting there, the high seat, the form in which he manifested his body was no different from the form of any one of us sitting here right now. Right now, our bodies are manifesting a round moon shape. Hooray. That's a big punchline, a big kind of, after hearing this whole story. Right now, our bodies are manifesting a round moon shape, a round moon expression, signs of a complete moon.
We're manifesting kinship.
Manifesting seeing is like, you know, if we make kensho into a noun, I think then we could say we're manifesting the show.
Yeah.
We don't even have to worry about the ken. We're manifesting Buddha nature and as a complete moon shape, we're ensoing instead of ken showing. it's wonderful, I think, that those in Zen with those circles, they're not always this way, but it's quite characteristic of a Zen Enso circle that it's like it's a complete circle, but there's a style of like lifting the brush just before the end. Isn't that kind of a cool little thing? Instead of like, ta-da, done, it's like, not quite yet. Even though right now we're manifesting Enso. Our Enso maybe looks like it's not quite joined. It looks that way. But it's an Enso. They're called complete circles, even when the ends don't quite meet. Maybe that's the point of making sure the ends don't meet and still making sure to call it a complete circle form. The manifesting body is not square or round. It's not existing or non-existing. It's not revealed or concealed. It's not a compound of 84,000 skandhas. It's just a body manifesting itself. So, classic kind of Madhyamaka, Prajnaparamita type of talk. It's not this, it's not that, it's not this, it's not that. It's just this manifestation. It's nothing that we can say it is, and yet it appears right now in this body. How can we deny this body appearing here and now? As for the round moon shape, where do you think you are speaking of the fineness or roughness of the moon? Which comes from some old Zen stories. Where do you think you are speaking of fineness or roughness? Since self and ego are from the self and conceit or pride are from the first excluded from this manifested body, the manifesting body is not Nagarjuna. You could say this independent self is from the first excluded from this manifested body, from the first, you can hear as from beginningless time in this manifested body. We don't have to eliminate some kind of Atman. If there were this permanent independent Atman, we'd have a very hard time eliminating it. But if it's not here in the first place, it's from the very first. It's, you know, it's not really that it's eliminated, it's just that it's never been here in the first place, then the manifesting body is not Nagarjuna, or, you know, not the person who thinks I'm Nagarjuna. It's the body of all Buddhas. Since it's expressing thereby, it breaks through beyond all Buddha bodies. Because of that, it's completely free of Buddhahood. So it It's the body of all Buddhas, but since it's constantly expressing, it breaks through beyond all Buddha bodies. This is Dogen's, you know, going beyond that he likes to bring up. Okay, this body is the Buddha body, but it's going beyond, it's breaking through and going beyond all Buddha bodies. Because of that, it's completely free of Buddhahood. That's what Buddhahood means for Dogen, is the freedom from Buddhahood. Although clearly and distinctly embodying the form of the full moon, Buddha nature, it's not a round moon shape set out on display. Much less is there any sight or sound in the preaching it expounds. The manifesting body is not a form or mind. It's not a skanda, base, or field. These are Indian Abhidharma terms, the five, and they're all the ways that we think of the person. The three different analyses of the person, which are, you know, maybe you've heard of the five skandhas. When we look for a person, we find form, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. That's one kind of analysis we can do to look for something other than five skandhas and not find one. But another one, instead of the five skandhas, is the six ayatanas. I mean the 12 ayatanas. Anyone know? The 12 ayatanas and the 18 dhatus?
No.
No? Well, with...
I smell, tongue, and taste, touch, and look, we mix them up. Yeah. 18 are the three that make the manifestation of the organ of consciousness and the consciousness and the thing that we call the consciousness.
Yes. Yeah. So they. It's kind of nice that the Buddha and in the Abhidharma, you often see these three lists together: skandhas, the ayatanas, and the dhatus. And they're just like, and he talks about these are for different inclinations of people. Some people like a shorter list, so we give them five skandhas. Some like a longer list, we give them 18 dhatus. But they're all basically, they come down to the same point. And they have different flavors, you know. It's really neat to actually like meditate on using these kind of teachings to kind of like play with, like, looking at your experience in terms of these lists. They're very useful. We don't bring it up in Zen so much, but it's all about, like, you just see all this ever-changing stuff that we call experience. Five skandhas we're familiar with more because it's in the Heart Sutra. But like you say, the 12 are, the faculty or organ and the color or form, ear and sound, nose and palate, tongue and taste. Body and touch, and then the six is mind, the mental faculty, and mental objects. And then the 18 is the same list of 12, but you add in the a consciousness for each sense. Each sense has its own, you know, there's an eye consciousness, an ear consciousness, and so on. And of course, a mind consciousness. And, and basically, the one thing about these three lists, skandhas, ayatanas, dhatus, are each one of them is completely all inclusive. Like there's basically everything in our experience can be fit into this list of the five skandhas. And if you take the other model, it's like they're not like combined. It's like they're different models. So if you take the 12 ayatanas, everything in our experience fits into one of these. You know, a lot of them fit into mental objects, like all our thoughts and ideas are mental objects. But everything's included in each list. So is so this is a neat part here because he says. Dogen says, the manifesting body that we're talking about here is not form or mind. It's not a skanda, base, or field. And then next sentence is, although it is identical, the skanda base and field, it is expressing thereby, which is this line he keeps saying, and it is the original body of all Buddhas. So I can hear that these meditations on the skandhas, ayatanas, dhatus are usually taught. I think the main function that they're taught for is to kind of like examine in our experience whether we can find some underlying independent self in addition to these lists. Right? That's the function of them. They're a meditation on self. And you could, so Dogen's saying, this body is not one of these things, like the Heart Sutra says. Also, there's, you know, in emptiness, there's no form, no feeling, no perception, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue. He goes through those three lists in the Heart Sutra, right? So Dogen kind of does that. And then he says, but it is the expression or the manifestation that we're talking about is identical to these things. So Buddha nature is not these fixed dharmas, these categories, and yet the expression of Buddha nature is the expression of eyes and ears and nose and tongue and so on. All the phenomena and experiences of our life are these expressions. So it's this, you know, it's a middle way teaching. It's not any of these things, and he says, although it is these things, the way it is these things, it is, he quotes, expressing thereby, which is this piece of the quote that he's pulling out. All of these things are expressions thereby, and it's the original body of all Buddhas. This is a skanda preaching the Dharma. It has no established form, and when an unestablished form is formless samadhi as well, it is the manifesting body. So again, it's back and forth. It's a skanda. It's this particular quality of experience, of ordinary experience, teaching the Dharma. But that skanda has no particular established form, and when this unestablished form is in formless samadhi, in meditation, it is the manifesting body. Yeah. It kind of keeps going over the same territory, but he just loves expressing this stuff again and again. Oh! Well... I guess that's where we'll stop.
Should we continue?
Halfway. Getting close to halfway now. Yeah, so Dogen goes on about this story for a while. He likes this one, and he talks about how he, you know, actually sees these paintings of the Nagarjuna as a full moon circle and stuff, and has conversations about that. So as I say, we'll continue going through, maybe skipping around some in Sishin, and Sishin's so great because it's like we can hear these Buddha nature teachings and then sit and just express, manifest Buddha nature, and then hear a little bit more about it, and then just sit and express it, and then do a little like gardening to express it, and then hear some more about it, and then eat to express it, and then do the dishes to express it. So of course, even if we're not in Sishin, we can do all those things, but you could say the Sishin is nothing but just like spending a week just expressing Buddha nature. There's no other purpose, you could say. That's what's so great about it, because often we get distracted by the other purposes, things we have to do. We forget that they're actually just expressing Buddha nature. So you're all welcome to come sit, and I've enjoyed this class with you thus far. studying Dogen. It's always a joy. So thanks for hanging in there all these weeks. We dedicate any merit arising from this class series to all living beings everywhere. May their expression of Buddha nature be unhindered and joyful. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.